Now, time for a catch-up on stories that are making headlines around the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, rising taxi fares in Cameroon and the smell of weed in New York City. But first we go to Turkey, where in 2 weeks' time the country is set to vote in a general election in what is shaping up to be the toughest challenge President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has faced in his two decades in power. Public anger has been mounting since the earthquakes in February, which saw tens of thousands perish when their shoddily built homes collapsed, a direct consequence of Erdogan's laissez-faire approach to regulation. But will this be enough to unseat the bombastic president, whose populist brand of religious conservatism commands the devotion of millions of voters? From Turkey, Lorraine Malander reports.
Feelings are running high at Atatürk Park, site of nearly 1,000 tents sheltering survivors of the twin quakes that destroyed the city of Kahramanmaraş in southern Turkey nearly 3 months ago. Two men, one inside the park, the other just outside, are arguing about the country's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The only thing preventing them from coming to blows are the high railings separating the park from the pavement. "Even with all the problems here, we will still vote for Erdogan," bellows the stocky red-faced man inside the camp, who seems ready to bound over the railings to land a punch on his opponent. "I will never vote for him. He is the cause of our problems," shouts the slender young man on the pavement, now being held back by some passers-by who stopped for the spectacle. After all the death and destruction wrought by the earthquake, the subject of the upcoming election on the 14th of May seems relatively minor. After all, natural disasters on this scale don't happen very often. Indeed, the World Health Organization called it Europe's worst natural disaster for a century. Given the context, it's surprising that the election should be taking place at all. But for many in Kahramanmaraş, left in ruins by the earthquake which killed around 50,000 people, displacing millions across southern Turkey, this is the most important election of their lives. Here in the epicentre, conflicting feelings about Erdogan can be felt in their full magnitude. Nestling at the foot of the Ahir Mountain, Kahramanmaraş, a city of around 1 million, has long been a stronghold of Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, the AKP, which is rooted in political Islam. Around three quarters of the city's voters backed him in the 2018 election. The city's devout, hard-working folks see Erdogan, the son of a humble coast guard who sold lemonade and sesame buns on the streets of Istanbul when he was young, as one of them. They feel he sticks up for conservative values, and they're proud to see him flexing his muscles as a regional leader. As witnessed at Atatürk Park, many Erdogan loyalists are with him for life, seeing him as the only leader capable of fixing the country, even in the midst of a deepening economic crisis which has seen inflation soaring and the value of the lira plummeting. They hark to his previous track record of economic growth and prosperity, even if that dynamism was overly reliant on a construction sector allowed to get away with substandard building practices, an industry that erected buildings doomed to collapse. They believed him when he blamed fate for the disaster, saying it had all been destiny's plan. But many have changed their minds. It was already apparent in the days following the earthquake when locals threw stones at the mayor, a member of Erdogan's AKP, angry at the delayed rescue and relief response. Locals at Atatürk Park, who've lost friends and families, jobs, possessions, money, now shiver in their tents at night, worrying about what the future holds. People are openly asking about Erdogan's apparent misappropriation of earthquake taxes imposed after Turkey's 1999 earthquake. Many express anger with the government. "Almost all my friends are furious with him, even those who loved him before," says İpek, a 24-year-old nurse met on the streets outside the park. "I will vote for the opposition. I don't think Erdogan will fix things." İpek will vote for Erdogan's main rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu of the Republican People's Party, who's leading polls by a hair's breadth. The candidate, who bears more than a passing resemblance to Gandhi, both in terms of temperament and appearance, was the first on the scene after the earthquake. He has vowed to rebuild people's destroyed homes for free. Few in the city really seem to believe this, but Ali, 49, waiting for a bus outside the camp, says he's ready to vote for Kılıçdaroğlu just to get rid of Erdogan, who he calls a liar and a dictator. But 600 kilometres away in the capital, Ankara, the earthquake seems more remote from voters' minds. Mehmet, 33, who works in finance, says people want to see improvements in their quality of life. In the past year, prices have shot up. There's a lot of anger against Erdogan, so people are betting on this guy Kılıçdaroğlu. He's making a lot of promises, but it all seems a bit vague. It's a gamble, he says. Erdogan is very charismatic. People like to see him with other world leaders. He's a likeable character. He's like a people's man, he says. Berk Esen, a professor of political science at Sabancı University in Istanbul, thinks Kılıçdaroğlu is not running a very energetic campaign. He's counting on the economic crisis and the earthquake having weakened the government so much that all he has to do is make some loose promises to win, he says. Even now, at his weakest point, Erdogan still has an air of invincibility. It remains to be seen whether the wave of public anger over the earthquake will unseat him. Either way, this knife-edge election will be the toughest he's ever faced. For World Report, this is Lorraine Malander.
Next, we go to Cameroon, where rising petrol and diesel prices have led to an increase in taxi fares, hitting Cameroonians hard in the pocket, as Dorcas Akupe reports.
Mr. Martin Fosong stopped a taxi from Etugebe in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, where he lives, and suggests he will pay 250 CFA francs, which is about 0.38 euros, to get to Lonkak. The driver refuses and insists on 300 CFA francs. Fosong Martin shakes his head in disagreement and then says it is too expensive, and the driver takes off. After about 15 minutes, this man in his late 50s wonders aloud, would one survive in Cameroon like this? The fare increase was announced few months back, and the drivers are already putting the prices up. He stops another taxi and proposes 300 CFA francs, and the cab driver accepts, and Fosong Martin is on his way. Like that Yaoundé resident, many Cameroonians woke up few months ago to hear that urban, regional and rural transport fares had increased after Cameroon's Minister of Trade, Luc Magloire-Baga Atangana, signed a ministerial order endorsing the rise in transport fares across the Central African nation. But the minister's order was just in response to the pleas of drivers who were struggling to make a living following the increase in the price of petrol. The price of petrol rose by 15.4% and diesel by 25.2% at pumps in early February. However, the government also took some measures to ease the pressure on households by increasing civil servant salaries by 5.2%. Most Cameroonians are not happy with the increase, who say the surge in the prices of fuel that has triggered a rise in transport fares is by far higher than the increase in wages. However, most Cameroonians are not happy with the increase, who say the surge in prices of fuel that has triggered the rise in transport fares is by far higher than the increase in wages. Ngoran Nadine, a denizen of Bamenda, chief town of Cameroon's northwest region, says some drivers are taking advantage and adding an extra 50 CFA francs during the day. She adds that the rise in prices of taxi fares also leads to time wasting, as passengers and taxi drivers now spend longer time bargaining because many people don't have money to pay the increase in the fare. Though the population is feeling the heat of the increase in fares, drivers are instead breathing some sighs of relief, even though they are not getting it easy with passengers. Paul, a driver in Bamenda, says some passengers complain that they don't have enough money and that they are not civil servants. He also adds that some persons have resorted to walking because they cannot afford to pay the extra. For regional transport, most travel agencies have not increased their fares for passengers, but instead have charged extra for luggage. Some people are also forecasting a further increase in the prices of many basic commodities, as the current prices does not include the recent increase in the transport costs. Danjo Lazarus, a civil servant in Mara, capital of the far north region of Cameroon, says the prices of essential goods will soon add again, and the 5% increase in salaries will not cover even a third of this increase in prices. This primary school teacher suggests the government further augment salaries and family allowances to lessen the plight of families. In a country where over 30% of the population live below €2 a day, the citizens of Cameroon are hoping for more measures to lessen the burden imposed by increase in tariffs. For World Report, I'm Dorcas Ekupe in Marua, Cameroon.
Finally, we go to New York City, where the aroma and sale of cannabis is seemingly everywhere after recreational use of the drug was decriminalized. Now authorities are grappling with how to control public consumption of the drug in the weed-friendly Big Apple. From New York, Mary Fitzgerald reports.
If you've been to New York over the past 2 years, you probably notice that the city smells different. Drifting from street corners, moving cars and subway trains is the distinctive aroma of cannabis. In March 2021, New York joined more than 20 other U.S. states in legalizing recreational cannabis use. Since then, it seems to be everywhere in the Big Apple. Last summer, New York's Mayor Eric Adams joked that the number one thing he smells in the city is cannabis. It's like everyone is smoking a joint now, he said. The New York Times has appointed a city cannabis correspondent. One well-known tourist guide has proclaimed 2023 the year of weed in New York and offers advice to visitors on how to partake. The law says that anyone aged over 21 is now legally allowed to buy, sell, consume, and grow cannabis for recreational purposes, within limits. Smoking the drug is not allowed in public spaces, including parks, beaches, restaurants, and bars, but that rule is clearly ignored. Around Times Square are signs with the message, "Let's be blunt, no smoking in the plazas." The legalization rollout has been anything but smooth. The slow state licensing process means just a handful of legal dispensaries have opened. Instead, some 1,500 unlicensed vendors have sprung up across the city, selling unregulated products that activists fear could pose health risks. Parents have complained that some of these sellers have set up shop near schools. Educators say they are worried about the increase in student cannabis consumption. This February, Mayor Adams warned that children were going to school high on marijuana-laced gummy bears they could buy at the corner shop. On April 20th, New York marked 420. For decades, this was the date when campaigners protested the legal restrictions on cannabis. Now it is celebrated not just with street festivals, but lots of buying and selling of the once banned drug. Outside a Lower Manhattan dispensary operated by Housing Works, a nonprofit that supports the homeless and people living with HIV and AIDS, customers queued up long before opening time on 420. Inside, staff served donuts decorated with cannabis leaf motifs. A sales assistant told me that many of their clientele were trying cannabis for the first time. "I don't know where to start," said one such customer, a woman in her 50s, before she bought some cannabis-infused sweets. Housing Works was New York's first licensed dispensary, opening its doors last December. It benefited from the fact the state has reserved its first round of licenses for nonprofits, as well as applicants with cannabis-related convictions, an acknowledgement that decades of prohibition disproportionately affected certain communities. As recently as 2017, New York City recorded more than 18,000 arrests for cannabis possession, of which more than 90% were for possession in public view or public consumption. There had been hopes that a supervised cannabis industry would promote social justice while generating billions in tax revenue and ensuring users consume safe products. But these aspirations have been challenged by the profusion of unlicensed vendors who are cashing in because their prices are lower than those in legal dispensaries. The era of criminalization may be over, but New York's experiment in legal cannabis is very much a work in progress. For World Report, this is Mary Fitzgerald in New York.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.